Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. As we heard in last week's episode, there are many ways to tell a biographical story. No matter what form, whether it's audio, graphic, visual, or literary, the rigor of research is the same. In this episode, I talk with award-winning filmmaker and showrunner Janice Engel about the years it took to create her feature documentary film, Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. It premiered at the 2019 Sundance Film Festival, won the Audience Award at South by Southwest, and won numerous other festival awards. It was released by Magnolia Pictures in August 2019. I began our conversation by asking Janice to introduce Molly Ivins.
Molly Ivins, a 6 foot tall, red-haired Texan who took no prisoners. You know, she was larger than life. She spoke truth to power. She gave voice to those that didn't have a voice. And boy, do we need her right now. But she was a political columnist who went after both sides of the aisle. She basically went after stupidity. She could drink any guy under the table, too. That was cachet in Texas. That was a seat at the table. And here's something super important. She was a student of history. She was brilliant. She read 6 newspapers every morning before she wrote her columns. Before she wrote her column, you know, became a columnist, she was a reporter. Third generation Smithy. She was born into WASP wealth, so to speak, from her mother's side. She was also known as Mole, the Mole. The Mole is in her hole when she was a little girl because all she ever did was read. In 1972, Ronnie Duggar, who started the Texas Observer, which is still hanging on, but they were basically put in the position of being co-editors of the only liberal, you know, supported by the people newspaper in the United States. And they were two young women. She went for the brass ring and jumped to the New York Times in 1976 or 77. They wanted her for her voice, and then they fired her for her voice. You know, and then she became a political columnist. I mean, there's so much more. You should see my film, Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. It will not only, as I like to say, how many documentaries make you laugh?
You worked on this film for 7 years. Where did you start your research process?
So my friend, James Egan, who became my producing partner, I'm Janice Engel, he's James Egan. We were going to call ourselves J-E squared. I always made bio docs. My first one I edited was Marvin Gaye back in 1984. Jackson Browne, Fleetwood Mac, a lot of music docs, a couple won awards. And then I got into the world of, you know, I fell backwards into documentary filmmaking. As Molly Ivins always said, she fell backwards into being a journalist. Anyway, James called me and he said, you have to go see this play at the Geffen. I live in Los Angeles. And he said, it's about Molly Ivins. And I didn't want to say, who's that? But that was the bubble in my head. It's called Red Hot Patriot, the kick-ass wit of Molly Ivins. And he said, you have to go. I said, why? And he said, because I had to last week. And I just laughed. And he said, he knew the playwrights, the Engel sisters. And I have to go because she went last week. He goes, well, it's closing this week. I said, and? He says, oh, and it stars Kathleen Turner. That was the carrot. And I said, okay. So I bought a ticket. I got third row, just slightly off center. And I laughed my ass off the entire time. I was blown away. There was lots of footage of her on the big screen behind Kathleen. Kathleen was great. She really embodied Molly Ivins. And in fact, I went to see it again in DC when she was at the arena several months later. And she was even better. I came home and I Googled Molly Ivins because I could till 2 or 3 in the morning. And all the C-SPAN stuff came up. And I just said, and I called up James in the morning. I said, how come I didn't know about it? Because I didn't know about her either. And he said, I saw Allison and Margaret Engel, the sisters. He said, I saw Allison and nothing has been done. I said, nothing. He said, just the play. I said, nothing. There was one bio out that was pretty good. James set up a meeting with Allison Engel. She said, well, you need to get in touch with Molly's chief of staff. We emailed Betsy Moon. She IMDb'd James and I said, oh, they're for real. They have some credits. We basically started chatting and then she put us in touch with Molly's manager who was handling her estate. Molly Ivins died in 2007.
She left behind hours and hours and hours of clips. And I'm sure her archive is massive. And
Yes.
your documentary film is under 2 hours. So how were you able to take all of this information and condense it into a really beautifully told narrative?
Well, it's a process. Making documentaries is a process. So I immediately started Googling, C-SPAN, and I got into C-SPAN, and I started downloading or whatever. Were they sending us tape? They were selling us tape. I was so once Dan Green, so here's the deal. Once Dan Green gave us the green light, and so Molly left her estate to the ACLU and the Texas Observer. We got the green light, and I read the bio book. I quickly read it, and then I got in touch with Dr. Don Carlton. Don Carlton runs the Briscoe Center for American Studies, I believe. And that's where Molly's papers are held, as well as Ann Richards and every other amazing Texan. I lived and breathed in the Briscoe Center for American Studies at different periods over the 6.5+ years. My first thing was to basically start aggregating, first of all, read her books and start aggregating as much information. But because I'm a visual person and I'm a filmmaker, I immediately started just grabbing. I Movavi screen captured so much footage. I just started. I was obsessed. For 5.5 years, I directed and edited it. And then I brought in Monique Zavistowski, as we called her, the Beast, to help me for the last 8 months. I mean, my producing partners had to dig me out of holes several times. I would go down the wormhole, and I had to make a living. That's why I started teaching.
You read this biography of Molly Ivins written by somebody that Molly knew, right? A friend of hers. Why did you feel like the world needed more Molly Ivins?
Okay, Molly was that 6-foot-tall, flame-haired Texan with size 12 shoes, who basically was that tall glass of water for people who were parched in areas where they found out that they were surrounded by people who did not necessarily agree with their point of view. Oh my God, are we here? We're here again. And so she was that tall glass of water that made them quench their thirst and made them feel like they weren't crazy. I mean, I love stories of fearless women who speak truth to power and stand up for something that's greater than themselves. We need those totems, especially women. Come on now.
It's kind of a birth to death documentary film on Molly Ivins. So, how did you categorize each phase of her life, or how did you like organize your research?
Well, because I'm a director who edits, I'm extremely obsessive, compulsive, and I'm detail-oriented. The first thing you do is, especially with somebody's life, is the chronological order. There's many different structures that you can do. Storytelling is storytelling. But I had to learn everything about her from her parents were all the way up through when she died and after. Molly is filled with themes. There's tons of themes. So the other thing I do is I use index cards old school, and I get a big cork board, and I basically started breaking it down chronologically and then by theme. Bios are written, right? They're told, they're written. But why would you make a film about it? Everybody read Molly Ivins. She was on late night. I mean, when I realized I didn't know who Molly Ivins was, I knew of her. I had heard she had dubbed George W. Bush Shrub, the little bush, which I thought was very funny. And I'd seen her on some late night show. But I really didn't know her. The A story is Molly Ivins, her life. The B story, or you can also break it down, classic storytelling, the protagonist, the antagonist. Does the character get what they want and need? Or do they get just what they want and not what they need? Or do they get what they need and not what they want? Or if they don't get both, it's a tragedy. Molly's is a little bit of both. But the A story was Molly. The B story was Texas. Texas is a character in her story. And there's Texas, the history of Texas, how a woman comes up. It's about newspapers, journalism. It's about being fearless, speaking truth to power.
But you created this really beautiful tapestry by interviewing really famous people that Molly Ivins had worked with or had criticized, or in some way their lives overlapped. So, how were you able to get people like Dan Rather and Cecile Richards and Rachel Maddow on your show to fill in as character witnesses of Molly Ivins?
Well, first of all, Texas is a big state, but very small world, especially if you're a progressive and you speak truth to power and you were Molly Ivins. And so Molly had a huge network. What happened was once we got the green light, we hit the road, we brought on a third partner because we needed a Texan, Carlyle Vandervoort. She grew up exactly like Molly Ivins. She grew up in River Oaks. She went to St. John's. She came from a well-to-do WASP family, a child of oil and gas privilege. They're several generations apart, but we needed Carlisle to basically be able to talk because she speaks Texan, and especially when you're raising money. The first thing I did was I headed out to Houston, and we did our first five interviews. And Molly's people, through Betsy Moon, her chief of staff, finally somebody's doing something. So every door opened for me, every single door. And politics in Texas is small. I mean, everybody knows everybody. That first trip, when I did my first six interviews, we did a fundraiser in Jim's office, which is a church, which we call the Church of Hightower. And out the gate, we raised $17,000. The three partners, we each put in, like, not each 10, we put in a total of $10,000 split three ways to get us started. We're crazy people, documentary filmmakers. But we do it because it has to be done, it has to be told. I mean, Cecile, I interviewed Dave Richards in that first six. That's Cecile's dad. I had so many stories about when they used to go camping. I did 38, almost 40 interviews. Not everybody made it in. I had people who were Republicans who were pricked by Molly Evans, but they gave me an interview. At the end of the day, the voice you really want to hear is Molly's.
How were you able to get access to Molly's brother and her family and all of those wonderful images and stories to create Molly's early life?
I got a hold of Molly's sister, Sarah, who was wonderful, and I couldn't get Andy. For a year and a half, I tried. I had been to Texas, so they had to get to know me. I don't remember. I think somebody said, Janice Engel is trying to reach you about Molly, and you need to call her back. And I don't know, I got a phone call, and he goes, like, hey, he's got this deep voice. I hear you've been trying to reach me. I said, Andy Ivins, where have you been? And he said, well, my wife and I want to host you. You come on down to the ranch. And it was the ranch that Molly bought with Andy. We went down and we spent a couple of days. Andy was incredible. What's so sad is he had cancer and his cancer returned and he passed away. He never got to see the film finished. But when we did our Kickstarter campaign, his wife went in and Carla, she gave us Molly's motorcycle jacket, things we could auction off and, different things like that. And so we blew past our goal in the first 10 days. And that's because Annie Lamott is in the film. Annie Lamott was best friends with Molly. Bonnie Raitt was friends. And I did a documentary on Jackson Brown, so I knew, Bonnie. And in a 24-hour period, we got $24,000. Another, we got $22,000. And another, we got $15,000. I mean, it was like, Molly's driving this bus. I'm just blessed to be on her ride. I had so many things happen like that, where it was like, when you do a biography and a person has passed, she's there. She was present. So at the end, thank you, the great state of Texas, the Dolph Briscoe Center for American Studies. Don Carlton said a year and a half before I locked picture, he said, when you're done with this, I really want to house your documentary. I said, you do? He said, oh yeah, I don't. We didn't know how it was going to do, but I said, that's such an honor. Absolutely, because Molly's papers are here. It should be here. So he said, so you're going to apply for grants from us. But he got the masters of all our interviews. So all the interviews I did are housed at the Briscoe Center, along with some of my papers and the film and the raw interviews and all of that sort of stuff. In three separate payments, I've got enough to take us through post-production.
And then you guys got into Sundance. How did you deal with imposter syndrome as a female filmmaker?
Yeah, well, we all suffer, we creatives, from imposter syndrome. Every time. I actually had it a little bit before I got on the Zoom with you. And I have no problem talking because once you get me started, I'm going. So we got an extension to apply for Sundance. I was also teaching. I had a full load. It was insane. I was editing here. I was going up to San Francisco. Anyway, we uploaded Monique Zavistowski, the editor who right now is shortlisted. Her short documentary, The Only Girl in the Orchestra, she edited, is up for a short Academy Award Oscar this year. Yay, Mo
I'm
Zavistowski.
going to watch it tonight.
It's fantastic. It's on Netflix. And Lisa Remington. Go, 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 girls. And Molly O'Brien, the director. Anyway, Mo and I were getting it and we got an extension. And it was like, it's like, I'm in this hotel in San Francisco. We're trying to upload. There's always something that goes wrong. Anyway, we got it in like a minute to midnight. And then I would come back and I would be editing with Mo. We had two stations. We're editing away. Mo is driving. I'm sitting back because we had two stations, two Avids. Poor thing. I made her go back to Avid because I had edited an Avid starting like in 2012. So it was November 18th. And a week before we had elected 101, 2018, we elected 101 women to become freshman congresswomen in the United States. That was pretty amazing. But the phone rings and Mo is there and I pick it up and this voice, male voice says, "Hi, is Janice Engel there?" I said, "Yes." And she, "Hi, this is Harry Vaughn. I'm calling you from the Sundance Film Festival." And I started shaking and I stood up and I wrote down, like I scratched it on a post-it, "Sun." I said, "Really?" He says, "I'm calling to let you know that we've selected your film, Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Adams, for its world premiere at the Sun." And I started jumping up and down. And Mo started jumping up and down like a little girl screaming at the top. Oh my God, oh my God. And we are screaming. And then my golden retriever, may he rest in peace, Scout, he starts barking and howling. And our other dog, Sadie, she starts, everybody. And we are, and he is laughing. And he said, "Oh my God." He says, "We're so happy. You've made us all so happy." And I said, "Well, this is like a once in a lifetime thing. I mean, here I am. I'm making a film about Molly Evans. It's taken me 6 and a half, almost 7 years, and we're in, and it's the world premiere. And I'm, are you kidding me?" And he said, "No," but he said, "We love your film. We want it. And it's not in competition. It's just, we're premiering it and we want blood," and whatever he said. And I was so knocked out. So was Mo. We could not believe it. And I said to him, "Wait a second." I said, wait, let's back up a second when we could calm down. I said, what, people don't jump up and down like they just won the lottery or they're like, got like the shoes they always wanted when they were like, you know, 8 years old, or they get to go to something they've never seen before." And he said, "No." I said, "Oh, come on, don't tell me. People are too cool for school." And he said, "Yeah, kind of." I said, "Okay."
Yes, but behind the scenes, everybody screams. One of my friends was just in Sundance. Come on. They scream behind the scenes. If our audience wants to see this film, where does it live right now?
You can stream it. We were in Sundance. We won. We had our world premiere. It did great. We had a big party. We were sponsored by the Texas ACLU. God bless them. And then we went to and South by Southwest. 3 days later, we got into South by Southwest. It was early. And normally they want the world premiere. But I had to talk to Janet Pearson and she said, "No, it's okay. We sometimes do this for very few films, but they can have the world premiere. We're going to have the Texas or American premiere, however." And we did it. And Cecile Richards introduced it. God bless Cecile. We won awards at Minneapolis St. Paul, Full Frame. We had standing room only, over 1,000 people. And it was only shown for one night. San Francisco Film Festival. We did a bunch of stuff, ones I couldn't make because it was between teaching and everything else, and I was going back and forth. And then Magnolia Pictures picked us up. It was between Magnolia and Neon, and the film premiered, where it's going to happen, the end of August. And like a week later, I'm looking at it saying, "Wait a second, the date is August 30th. And I'm looking at that day, and I said, and I call up the person, the contact, whoever I was talking to, the VPs, whomever at Magnolia, and I said, "Do you know what August 30th is? You're releasing the film." And they said, "Well, it's a great time to release it." I said, "It's Molly Ivan's 75th birthday. Are you kidding me?" I said, "Come on." And I said, "Who's driving this bus?" And they all knew. They said, I said, "That's right. Molly Ivan's driving this bus. We're just blessed to be on her ride."
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was in theaters, which is extraordinary. Thank God it was before COVID. From Alabama to Alaska for 18 weeks. That's unheard of. And then it jumped the pond. It went to the UK and Ireland, but COVID hit. And then it's been on for 3 years. It was on Hulu and then that ended. And now it's right now, actually, it's on Max for 2024 and 2025 from January to June. So right now, if you are on Max, you can watch it for free, I believe. And otherwise you can stream it. It's there. It's on every, you know, if you go to www.mollyivansfilm.com, you'll see all the different places it's streaming, or just type in your search bar, "Raise Hell, Molly Ivans," and it'll come up.
I watched it, I think, on Amazon Prime. Yeah.
Did it make you laugh?
I died laughing. That was award-winning filmmaker and showrunner Janice Engel talking with me via Zoom on February 10th, 2025 about her documentary film, Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. It was released by Magnolia Pictures in August 2019. This is our final episode in peeling back the curtain on Bio as an organization. If you have enjoyed this series, we would appreciate a review or a shout out on social media. Find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Blue Sky, and give us a follow. If you're not on social but want to let us know your thoughts anyway, visit our website and click on that contact tab. I'm Bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Our executive producer is Sonia Williams. Darren Nesblitt created our theme music. Thank you so much for listening.